This week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
Cruises, Waymos, Zooxes, all of these autonomous vehicles that are driving around the city, largely unregulated, very unwanted, taking money from the community, taking jobs from drivers.
San Francisco drivers and Teamsters demand that Waymo and other autonomous vehicles be taken off the street.
You see, we need to keep the wealth of the country here to benefit the Brazilian population. And in order to survive in the international arena, we need to build alliance with other countries, with the working class across the borders in order to bring a real solution for the problem that all workers are living today, which is capitalism. Capitalism is the problem. We need to finish capitalism.
Brazilian unionist Fabio Bosco discusses the challenges of the Brazilian working class.
One day, my parents brought home a little spinet upright piano, and I sat on that piano, and I just started playing, and I stopped crying. It was like the world opened up to me in sound.
In celebration of Women's History Month, we hear from pianist and composer Donna Wang Friedman. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Polina Vasilyev. Google is joining Waymo and other tech companies planning to flood the U.S. with autonomous robo-taxis and trucks, putting millions of drivers out of their jobs. On December 20, 2025, a power outage in San Francisco led to widespread problems for Waymo's self-driving cars. The blackout affected about one-third of the city and triggered roughly 1,600 vehicle stoppages lasting over 2 minutes, with many cars blocking intersections or stopping in the middle of roads because they could not interpret dark traffic signals. On March 2nd, Uber and Lyft drivers and Teamsters rallied at San Francisco City Hall and demanded that these autonomous vehicles be taken off the street. Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer interviewed the workers.
My name is Jason. I'm with Rideshare Drivers United. We're a driver-led union here in California.
And what's going on here today?
Today, we are protesting the Waymos. Cruises, Waymos, Zooxes, all of these autonomous vehicles that are driving around the city, largely unregulated, very unwanted, taking money from the community, taking jobs from drivers, you know, a lot of things that nobody really asked for and have been pushed through as policies before democratic deliberation of any real kind.
And where's the regulation? Where is the regulation? CPUC, what's happening with Governor Newsom? Apparently he's vetoed bills for regulation.
Yeah, Governor Newsom has vetoed bills specifically in trucking in 2013. Autonomous trucks, an incredibly dangerous concept that California was set up to keep off the roads until at least 2030, and he vetoed that. It was a very popular bill. And he's had that same pro-tech direction in these other fields, too. So the CPUC can control whether we have Waymos, Zooxes, and these things on the streets. They have allowed more and more of them, and that's largely under Gavin Newsom's influence.
And are you concerned about Waymos' health and safety? I know there was an electrical outage, and they shut down in the middle of the street.
Yeah, when they shut down the city, you know. In a way, you know, I look at that and I say, us drivers should be taking control of the streets. You know, we are the ones that actually make the city run. If things go wrong with the Waymos, you know, that just shuts down when things are at their worst.
And they had a hearing at the CPUC, and Waymo said that they couldn't even provide how many vehicles were on the streets at that time. What's
right.
Going on?
Just, I don't know, backroom deals. I mean, it was the whole room erupted in laughter and surprise when the judge asked, you know, how many of these Waymos were blocking the streets? And they said, that's a trade secret. We can't tell you. Nobody could even believe it. So that's the kind of lawlessness we're dealing with these tech companies. They need to be brought under some kind of democratic accountability because it's not happening right now. And I'm so glad to see so many people out here trying to make it happen.
And AI seems that the techno-fascists, the people that own it, control the Democrats and Republicans. Is that part of the problem?
You know, I'd say so. I think that the default is just to let the money run the system, you know, and take over more and more of it as these not very capable AI agents just push people out of their jobs, push people out of their communities. And we need to have the opposite attitude. It needs to be a people first. No problem with the technology as long as people are being enriched by it and using it themselves instead of the technology using people, which that's what we're seeing going on right now. The techno-fascism is just computers first, people second. We got to change that.
My name is Miguel D. Trinidad, South San Francisco. And I'm a Lyft and Uber driver, been doing it for a while. A great part-time job. I got a full-time job. But because I live in the Bay Area, you know, we need a little extra. And the platform's amazing. I was actually driving that night down North Beach, having to navigate through the traffic of the Waymos, actually asking people if they needed my support. It's challenging, and it's really challenging seeing in my neighborhood walking, driving down down El Camino. And so I'm really, really happy to be here to support the Teamsters, happy to support everybody over here, because I really don't want them in my neighborhood.
So you want Waymos off the street?
I want Waymos off my neighborhood block, period. Get away from the peninsula, get them away from everything.
Yeah, I'm Hector Castellanos from California Gig Workers Union.
And what's your purpose here in coming to this hearing?
So I'm here because we want to tell the board of supervisors about the Waymo, about the, you know, keep our streets safe and our jobs.
And it was said here that the 600,000 jobs may be at lost because of AV. Is this true?
You know, it's not just Waymo. We need to think about it's everything, right? If we just think about the AI, robots, and, you know, Waymo, it's going to replace a lot of jobs, not just the 720,000 drivers. So we really need to start thinking about all the people, because at the end, it's going to be only poor people and billionaires, right? So, like, for example, if you tell me any job can be replaced for AI and or drivers or robots, like Fremont Factory in Tesla Fremont Factory, they start building robots. So just imagine 1 million robots in McDonald's working, it's gonna be 3 million jobs they're gonna take away. So
this is an issue for all workers, you're saying?
Yes, correct.
Well, it seems that the legislature and Gavin Newsom has said that the tech companies can do what they want. Deregulation, I mean, that's Trump and Project 2025. Isn't that seems to be their agenda? They let it rip.
Yeah, but they have to start thinking about it, and they only have to have legislation. They only 5% of the worker force have to be or work or robots or AI or Waymos. That's it.
You think that the California Public Utility Commission should have that as part of its code or rules? The effect of the introduction of AI in the workplace?
Yeah, they should start thinking about it, and they should start stop all this.
And Gavin Newsom, the governor, has vetoed a bill requiring a driver, truck driver, if you have a truck over 10,000 pounds, he vetoed it twice. What does that say about what's going on in California?
Well, you know, like I say, it's very hard for everyone. You know, it's super hard for all the jobs they're going to take away.
And how is AI affecting drivers?
Well, AI, it's Waymo who's affecting drivers, right? No AI. But AI is going to affect other jobs. You know, like, for example, my daughter, she works in a hospital in San Ramon. It's a beauty hospital. They do, plastic surgery and all of that. And they have AI came to this company to start changing a lot of things. 20 people is going to be without job because AI.
And nurses, I understand, went on strike. In Santa Rosa, they're laying off 44 nurses and replacing them with AI.
Exactly.
Healthcare workers, chat boxes. They're having people talking to chat boxes rather than have.
Yeah, I know, right? You can see. You see. I mean, it's crazy. But yeah, they really need to start thinking, because if we don't pay our taxes, I have property and I pay property taxes, and that property taxes go to the county to pay the firefighters, to pay the police. So if we don't have work, if we don't pay our taxes, the government is gonna. He's not gonna get money, right?
My name is Thomas Lewis, Local 70, Oakland, California. I'm out here because we need safer streets. And, you know, we need to get rid of these AVs. We need people. We need a middle class. And safety issue. You know, we get tickets. They don't get tickets. So, I mean, how is that fair? Double standard. Hypocrisy at its finest.
And are you worried about autonomous trucks, AV trucks?
Yes. It's still, once again, it's safety. It's a safety issue. Technology. I mean, you're at home, your Wi-Fi goes out. We see what technology does. It's unreliable. At least we can rely on a human person. If something goes wrong, he can pull the vehicle over or whatever. So it's a safety issue all the way around. And then it's jobs.
The government's being controlled by these companies, Google and the
government. It's profit. It's money. That's all it is. It's profit. You know what I'm saying? Employees have to pay benefits for us, health insurance, all type of taxes. It's all about stockholders. It's all about profit. That's all it's about. Capitalism at its worst.
My name is Elena. I am a driver for Lyft and Uber, and I'm tired of Waymo being in the way, getting into accidents, almost hitting me. I've seen
them. When were you hit?
Pardon me?
When were you hit? Were you nearly hit?
Nearly hit. I've literally called it out with passengers in my car saying, look, watch, the car's going to pull over on me at any minute. Next thing you know, it crawls over into my lane. Call it every time. I've seen it almost hit a kid. I've seen it literally running a red light while somebody was crossing the street and almost hit them. They run red lights.
And what would happen to you if that happened?
Yeah, money was worth a lot back then.
Kicked out of Uber and Lyft?
Oh, I would lose my job instantly. Instantly, I would lose my job. There's no accountability for Waymo. They just take their car back to the shop and they get a new car out, and I lose my job until my car's fixed. And I can't pay for the car if I lose my job.
So this is a matter of survival for you?
Absolutely.
So why are they pushing these Waymos when they apparently stopped, with the electricity went out, they shut down?
They're eventually trying to get us all drivers off the street so that they can hoard the money for themselves. Inevitably, that's what it is.
So that's 700,000 drivers. It's a lot of drivers.
Absolutely. Absolutely. They're trying to get us off the streets so that they can take all the money for themselves. It's ridiculous.
What should the state do?
Ban them. Absolutely ban them. They are not good. Maybe out in the desert or in urban areas where there aren't that many, but in a major metropolis, absolutely, this is not the area to put them in.
And the state legislature and Newsom have allowed the CPUC and the DMV to allow this. Well, what do you say to them?
I love Newsom, but if he says that, absolutely not. I will not be on that one at all. I will fight him tooth and nail on that one.
That was a rally of Uber and Lyft drivers and Teamsters who were demanding that the Waymo robo-taxis owned by Google be removed from the streets.
The Department of War said to the AI corporations, we'll tell you the score, you stick to your stations. Give us what we want and we'll pay you very well. Dare to complain, go straight to hell. Because we just want your compliance, not you making a woke scene, saying you don't like mass domestic surveillance or autonomous killing machines. The Secretary of War was shocked at what he read. Such intransigence, what the CEOs say. You wanna be in our good graces, here's the drill. When we say do this, you say I will. Because we just want your compliance, not you making a walk scene, saying you don't like mass domestic surveillance or autonomous killing machines.
That was Misanthropic, written by David Rovix, performed by AI Tsuno. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Paulina Vasilyev. Fabio Bosco is a retired subway operator in São Paulo, a veteran trade unionist and organizer with the labor federation CSP Com Lutas, the popular trade union center, as well as the PSTU, Partido Socialista dos Trabalhadores Unificado, a political party. Here's part two of his conversation with Pacifica's Thomas O'Rourke about Brazilian politics and many other topics.
Brazil, as we know, is a giant of a country in area, population, economic output, cultural importance, diplomatic leadership. Please describe, and you've obviously already talked about quite a bit of this, please describe a few of the more pressing issues facing Brazilian workers and suggest to our audience how it the Brazilian working class, can find its way forward. And I say that to, and ask you to talk a little more about the deindustrialization. You mentioned early on that the Brazilian capitalism seems in the process of deindustrializing, at least in non-profitable industries. And you also hinted at its imperialist reputation within Latin America. So how can the Brazilian class move forward in such an important country? And as you've indicated, it does seem to sort of cry out for leadership of the working class in Latin America. What are your thoughts?
Thomas, I think that one big challenge for Brazilian working class has to do with the foreign capitals that are already here or are coming here, you see. So this dispute between the U.S. imperialism and China are in Brazil as well. Today in Brazil, in terms of capitals that are here, the strongest ones are the U.S. ones, but China is increasing. There is a gap, but China is the second one and increasing. It's in the upswing, let's say.
Yes.
And so this dispute between Trump and Xi Jinping is also here. And what happens? For instance, the Chinese capitals are coming to Brazil. Lula is welcoming them, but it does not mean proper jobs, good wages, nothing like this. It's capitalist exploitation like the U.S. companies do as well. So I think one challenge that we have in Brazil has to do with this imperialist capitalist presence, you see, because they drain the wealth of the country to the imperialist countries. So we need to address this issue of the imperialist countries, imperialist corporations here in Brazil.
Brazil seems in the process of trying to enter BRICS, and this could be a hopeful avenue to at least avoid pressure from the weakening U.S. dollar, pushed by declining yet aggressive American economic imperialism. So what is the attitude towards BRICS by both the capitalists, but more importantly, for our standpoint, from the point of view of the British Brazilian workers, their attitude toward BRICS?
What happens? The Brazil is one of the founders of the BRICS, okay? So Brazil is deeply integrated there, but there are different interests inside this BRICS leadership, you see? Let me describe a bit. For instance, for China's administration, BRICS might become a kind of economic and political alliance that benefits the Chinese capitalist corporations, you see. For Brazil wants to be in the BRICS, but does not want to break with the U.S. imperialism. Brazil wants to have one foot in each place, you see, one foot in the BRICS, one foot with U.S. imperialism, be Trump, be Biden, be whoever is in power. You see, it's a structural relationship. And Brazilian capitalists, they benefit from this, you see, rivalry between the U.S. and China, because they make business here, they make business there, and they try to balance themselves. So for Brazil, the Brazilian capitalists and the Brazilian administration does not want BRICS to become a whole alternative for U.S. imperialism. They want to keep it like this and keep the economic and political links to the U.S. and European capitalists. You see, that's more or less the perspective of the Brazilian bourgeoisie. For the Brazilian working class, some things may help. For instance, this issue of the weaker U.S. dollar. So the countries to trade without the frame outside the framework of U.S. dollars. Yes, maybe it's beneficial for Brazil and so for the Brazilian working class. But it's not a perspective of full liberation for the working class. You see, it's still a capitalist framework So the perspective that we work here is opposing all imperialist countries, corporations, because we don't see that we can benefit from one or the other, or one would be a kind of lesser evil. We don't understand it like this. We believe that we need a full liberation of Brazil and Latin America together with the emancipation of the working class. You see, we need workers' power. With workers' power, certainly, we will nationalize all these companies, you see, be US companies, be European, Chinese. You see, we need to keep the wealth of the country here to benefit the Brazilian population. And in order to survive in the international arena, we need to build alliance with other countries, with the working class across the borders, in order to bring a real solution for the problem that all workers are living today, which is capitalism. Capitalism is the problem. We need to finish capitalism.
Yes. Thank you, Fabio, for that answer. My last two questions revolve around domestic Brazilian society and its history. First is, how racist is Brazilian society? And I would note that it was the last country in the Americas to end slavery, and that it was not achieved through popular revolt or civil war, as far as I know, but was a reform in the late 1880s. And what must trade unions and the political left, the Marxist or otherwise, do to take up or renew the fight against racial oppression in Brazil?
Thomas, let me tell you, Brazil, half of the Africans that were unenslaved and brought to the Americas, they were brought to Brazil. And so Brazil today has the second largest black population in the world after Nigeria, you see? So yeah. This issue of racism in Brazil is a big issue, you see? And it's an issue that affects the majority of the Brazilians and the majority, even more, the majority of the working class, because the majority of the working class are black people, you see? So the struggle against racism in Brazil is a big issue. Unfortunately, the Brazilian state is still a racist state. In the law, everyone here is equal. And there are some affirmative actions, some limited, mainly regarding the access to the public universities. You see?
Yes.
So there are these achievements. They are modest, but they are still important. And we have to fight to keep them, you see? Because the far right is always campaigning to end any kind of affirmative action. Like in the US, we are in the same situation in Brazil. Brazil is still a racist country, maybe the most nastiest thing that I can tell you is the killing of people, you see. In Brazil, every year, something around 40,000 people are killed. The broad majority are young black people in the big cities, you see. It's something horrible.
This is the homicide statistics, or is this killings by police and military forces?
It's by the police. The remaining, there are all kind of things here, because we have some mafias that operate not only drugs, but the control of areas in the poor neighborhoods, you see. So it's what the movement here in Brazil calls the genocide of the black young people. One of the most important campaigns we have in Brazil has to do with exactly these killings. But there are many other campaigns that are related to the black people in Brazil that labor movement as a whole, they support. You see, not only us, which we are a more militant and independent section of the working class, but even the official mainstream labor federations, they also oppose all these manifestations of racism that we still have in Brazil. But what we see, Thomas, that this struggle against racism will go together with the struggle for workers' liberation. You see, they go together. And the final solution is workers' power, because the capitalists, they benefit from racism. They pay less wages for the working class. They divide the working class, you see? So they keep this issue all the time. They benefit from it. But the working class, we don't benefit from that. So it's a necessity for any struggle for workers' liberation in Brazil to address the issue of racism, as well as of sexism, of LGBT phobia, of xenophobia, because these issues divide the working class, you see. And in order to unite the working class, we need to address them. There is some sections of the left-wing organizations that they are uncomfortable with raising these issues, because they say that that's only identity politics. But we, as CSP Com Lutas, and my political party as well, we believe that we need to address these issues in order to unite the working class and to fight for a real change, you see, a socialist perspective in Brazil. Sure. So we address the struggle. We support all the struggles against racism, against sexism, LGBT phobia, xenophobia, because we need these struggles in order to unite the working class. We cannot, because these people that say that it's identity politics, they want to unite the working class, but to not pay attention in these issues that divide the working class. We have another perspective. We need to address them in order to unite the working class. The working class must be united under a non-racist perspective. That's the only way to unite the working class.
Yes, understood. And I definitely agree. The last question, well, second to the last question, the agrarian question in Brazil has yet to be solved for landed and unlanded peasantry who are just like the rest of the working class and the poor, subjected on occasion and sometimes to extremely intense violent repression by various police forces, rural landowner thugs, paid soldiers, mercenaries. What would a serious socialist workers' party say and do about the land question in Brazil? And what are the obstacles to this, obviously?
You know, Thomas, the best land in Brazil has very good land, and the best lands are under the property of big landowners, some of them international corporations and some of them national landowners. We see that the way to move towards a socialist perspective, we need to address this concentration of land in the hands of few people, few capitalists, national and foreign. We need to organize, you see, both the peasantry and the working class who works in these rural areas, you see, because we have both. We have small landowners who are peasants.
Yes.
And we have workers that work for these big landowners. Today, these landowners became a very powerful section of the Brazilian bourgeoisie because of the structure of the economy in Brazil. The industries are having less power, and the landowners more power together with the banks, you see? So we believe that we must support all struggles that goes in the direction of bringing justice, be it land reform, be it better wages for the agricultural workers. We believe that we need to build this alliance. Just one last, I would like just to add something. Many times the struggle against these landowners goes hand in hand with the struggle against racism and the struggle for native Brazilian rights, you see?
Yes. Yeah.
Something like 1% of the Brazilians are native Brazilians. You see, the people that were in Brazil before the
indigenous Brazilians. It's only 1%, huh?
Yes. Well, they...
That's of 200 million people, yes?
Yes, that's true.
Okay, it's, so that's about 2 or 3 million people?
A bit less than 2 million people.
Okay, okay.
But they have some achievements, you see. They have some reserves, some lands that are under their control. But all these achievements are under threat by big capitalist corporations, be them agricultural corporations or mining companies, you see. And so there is a big struggle, mainly in the Amazon area, around these issues, you see. So we are standing hand in hand with the native Brazilians. And recently, Thomas, there was something very good. Look, we had a victory here in Brazil regarding the privatization of rivers. Look, the Brazilian government, under pressure by the agribusiness corporations, they decided to privatize the river, I don't know how to say in English, river beds of some big rivers in order to export the soybean production that are in the middle of Brazil through these rivers to the Amazon and to the sea. You understand? But the native Brazilians, they held a very strong campaign. The main target is a company called Cargill. I think
it's an American conglomerate. Yes, Cargill, yeah.
Yes, and we managed to make Lula administration to withdraw this law, and now it's stopped. The privatization was halted.
Was it their intention to say this part of the river is ours, and therefore we can build facilities and turn it into a hub of production? Is that what was their intention was?
The main intention was to adequate the riverbed in order to big ships. You see, to export the soybean production to other countries using the riverbeds, you see.
So ecological imperialism, huh?
No.
Well, I thought Brazil's economy worked almost exclusively on long-distance trucking. The truckers from the Amazon are bringing goods to the ports along whatever the highway system there is, and I understand it's fairly advanced and quite good in places, correct?
Yes, the main production, the export moves mainly by trucks, but they are building this alternative, which is much cheaper, you see, to use the rivers of the Amazon area to export the production that is in the I don't know the words in English for this, the center west of Brazil is the main production of soybeans there, and so to export through the Amazon rivers would be economically very advantageous for the capitalists. But if you change the river beds, you see, to make them deeper, you start to affect all the riverside population. You see, many of them are native Brazilians. That's why they were opposed to this privatization project regarding the Amazon rivers, the rivers that goes to the Amazon River.
And this went to the Supreme Court of Brazil? It was decided there?
No.
A law was passed.
The native Brazilians, they occupied the one harbor where Cargill is for 1 month, and there was a national mobilization to tell Lula, you must stop this. And then you see, we are going to have elections in October, and for Brazil to impose this on the native Brazilians would be something that might have bring problems for Lula. So he suspended everything and We'll wait for the elections, and then he'll come again with the same project because
No doubt. The capitalists are very savvy. They know when to retreat, so to speak, or stop their predations, and then wait for a more opportune time to move forward with the agenda that doesn't seem to change, maximizing profits. Fabio Bosco, thank you so much for speaking to me today. It was a pleasure. Our conversation begets, in my mind, many more questions that hopefully we can discuss in the future. I see you as an expert on money topics, and I want to thank you. Is there anything else you'd like to say about the situation in Brazil or its relations internationally?
No, I just want to tell you, Thomas, that we are very happy to be here with you to address all these issues that are very important for us, but we believe that all these issues belong to the working class internationally, you see? Yeah. So we must keep the connections to build the necessary links among the working class in order to change the world into a socialist perspective.
That was veteran trade unionist and political militant Fabio Bosco of the Brazilian Labor Federation, CSP Com Lutas, the Popular Trade Union Center, and PSTU, Partido Socialista dos Trabalhadores Unificado, a political party. He spoke to CRD's Thomas O'Rourke.
É o Matheus no beat, malandro.
O Brasil aplauda agora os motoqueiros, os motociclistas, os entregadores de comida, que eles estão ralando pra comida chegar na sua casa.
Acordo cedinho, eu pego minha motoca na disposição, mochilão já nas costas. Dias de luta e dias de glória, só Deus conhece a vida dos motoca. Na rua trombo os parceiros da hora, na mesma luta também atrás das notas. Rap, iFood toca toda hora, os quatro cantos de Sampa na roda. Um pobre louco em busca do seu sonho, espalha alegria onde vai passando. Sua caminhada Deus tá abençoando, nada é em vão, continua acreditando. No sol ou na chuva ele tá batalhando, cliente chato vive reclamando. Cinco de taxa é o que eles vêm pagando. Esquece que nós também é ser humano. Mas nessa vida eu não posso ter pressa, porque em casa alguém me espera. Minha família depende de mim, algo mais valioso dessa terra. Entregue mansão e becos e viela, nós não dá falha e não amarela. Profissão, perigo, a vida que escolhi. O foco sempre é bater a meta. E pra matar.
That was MC Phelps, Vida de Motoboy. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Polina Vasiliev. In celebration of Women's History Month, we share part of an interview with the pianist and composer Donna Wang Friedman, conducted by Fahima Sek of WPFW, Pacifica Radio in Washington, D.C.
I'm Fahima Sek, and today my guest is Donna Wang Friedman, a concert pianist, an award-winning educator, producer, filmmaker, and creative visionary. And I'm so delighted, Donna, that you were able to join us today on Pacifica Radio. So before we get into your journey, tell us a little bit about your trip for International Women's Day.
I'm going to Antwerp, Belgium. I've never been there before. And I'm going to be performing with the Virago Symphonic Orchestra, led by Maestro Pascal Van Oost. This is one of the last remaining all-female orchestras in the world. So we'll be performing an entire program of music by women composers celebrating International Women's Day. And I can't wait. I'm so excited.
That sounds phenomenal. Now, I'd like you to tell those in our listening audience who Donna Wang Friedman is. What was it like growing up, and how did you come to music?
I grew up in Forest Hills, Queens, to a very traditional Chinese family. My parents came from China to the U.S., and I was the only Chinese kid in my entire school, and maybe the community, the neighborhood. So I was very shy. I was kind of, feeling out of place. And my mom told me to not draw attention to myself so that, you know, people might see how different I look and make fun of me. So I was very quiet, and my parents bought a little parakeet, which we named Green Spot. I have a half-brother older, 9 years older than me, and he took care of Green Spot, but I always said Green Spot was mine. Well, when I was 6 years old, Green Spot died. And that was the first time I'd ever experienced loss, and my heart was broken. I couldn't stop crying. And my mom, who was very superstitious, kept saying, please, you have to stop crying. It's bad luck. I couldn't stop crying. But one day, my parents brought home a little spinet upright piano. And I sat on that piano, and I just started playing, and I stopped crying. It was like the world opened up to me in sound. So they decided to give me piano lessons, and I took lessons from a local piano teacher. And one of the first pieces she gave me was by Robert Schumann, and it was called First Loss. And I performed that when I was 6 and a half at a student recital. And when I played that piece, I thought about Green Spot, my bird. And I was so emotional on stage performing that piece. And for whatever reason, that emotion, the story that I was telling, really was communicated to the audience. And I think it was the very first time in my entire life I felt like I had a voice. And that's when I realized I could tell stories through music. And that's what I did, you know, all growing up. Every time I had a new piece, I would make up a story that would go along with the music. And I communicated it. I love performing. I started to go to Juilliard Pre-College when I was 7 years old. And that was heaven on earth because I was with other students, other kids like me, who loved music as much as I did. And I enjoyed being on that stage because that was the time I felt free to speak from my heart. So from ages 7 to 17, I was performing, winning competitions. And the natural, you know, next step would have been to go to Juilliard for college. But, you know, my parents are, as I said, traditional Chinese parents. And they didn't think that music was a very, you know, good career. It's very difficult, and they wanted something stable for me. So I went to Princeton University.
Just hear. I understand that this is off your album and it is from your film dedicated to your father. What did we just hear? The musical selection.
That was the Chopin Waltz in C sharp minor. And that piece is at the center of the short film that I created called Never Fade Away, which is my father's immigration story. It's a story of how my dad escaped his homeland, Ningbo, China, in the 1940s during the Japanese invasion. He came to this country with nothing but his hopes and dreams, and how a radio and a waltz changed his life. And that's the waltz. So the Chopin Waltz, I was 13 years old when my father told me his story, the story about how he had to escape his homeland, came here. And that Chopin Waltz became our special piece. And from that day, when I was 13, living in Forest Hills, Queens, from that day on, after every single concert, and I still do this, I would always play that Chopin Waltz as my first encore, you know, dedicated to my parents.
How did the film come to be? What was the genesis of the film?
Well, is everything in my life. It seems to have, you know, kind of evolved through many different phases. I think it started during the pandemic when we were all isolating, right before the pandemic, actually. I was walking my dog and all the news of the coronavirus from Wuhan were spreading like wildfire. I was walking my dog in Central Park at 1 p.m. during the day, and out from nowhere, this very large man lunges towards me, and he starts screaming at me, calling me every horrible name in the book, and he told me to go back to China or, you know, regret being here, and threatening. And he was very close to me to, you know, I don't know what he could have done. Luckily, a group of passerbys walked by and he fled into the park again. But that event shook me up. I ran back to my apartment with my dog and I didn't leave it for 7 months. I wouldn't walk out to walk the dog. My husband tried to get me to go with him. He said, you know, nothing's going to happen to you. We'll walk together. He said, I can get you pepper spray. I'll be by your side. And I refused to go out. And the reason was, is that I didn't want people to look at me and blame me for, at that point, what they were calling coronavirus instead of COVID. So for those 7 months, I stayed home, listened to a lot of music by Asian composers, did a lot of reading and a lot of reflecting. And I realized that some of this anti-Asian hate was really about fear of the unknown. At that time, no one knew why the coronavirus was spreading like wildfire. People were dying. People were scared. So it was fear and ignorance, not looking at me as an individual, but thinking of me as someone from China who spread this virus. The ignorant part is that they didn't take any time to get to know who we are. So that was the time when I started creating my Heritage and Harmony programs with the idea of sharing our stories of heritage to show everybody, you know, that these stories of resilience, of hope, we all have them because we all come from somewhere else. You know, it's not just about my parents' story. It's about your parents, your uncles, your aunts. It could be anybody who you love and care about coming to this country for the first time. We all have these stories that connect us. So I started sharing my father's story, the one he told me when I was 13. I started sharing them on virtual programs. I must have performed 48 virtual concerts during the pandemic. And then when the doors open, I started in concert, sharing his story by talking about it and playing the waltz. And then I actually had the waltz choreographed by my dear friend, the incredible choreographer, Ariel Grossman. And at one of these live concerts where I shared the story and it was told through dance, a woman came up to me. And she said, I'm a filmmaker. This is the most beautiful story. You really should make a film out of it. And I went home and I thought, oh, isn't that so silly? I'm not a filmmaker. I never went to film school. How can I make a film? Then I started thinking about it. And I said, you know, what I could do is tell the story and the dance and film the dance. And I started, you know, working on finding a place to film the dancers. And the dancers that I've been working with, you know, are incredible dancers. And so I wanted to film it in a place that we used for rehearsing the dances. And so I was able to book a place that I could afford for a Sunday in March. And I called my dancers and I talked to Jesse. And Jesse Obremski, a fantastic dancer. And I said, this is what I'd like to do. I'd like to film this and make a short film. It's about 4 minutes long about the dance. Can you do this? And he said, oh my goodness, I can't do this because I'll be away, you know, that entire month. And I was crestfallen because He was the person that danced the role of my father. And, you know, I didn't know what to do. So I thought about Chen Wei Chan. I read about him. He is the history-making first ever Chinese-American principal dancer of the New York City Ballet. And I've watched him dance, and I thought, oh my God, what do you think? I'm thinking this would be such a dream if he would do this with me. So I called my friend, and of course I thought it was a total long shot, but you know what? At my age, I'm not afraid of getting turned down. You have to be in it to win it, right? So I figured I have nothing to lose. I can see if he would be interested. And if he says no, that's fine. So I called my friend, who is the pianist for the New York City Ballet, Alan Moverman. We went to Juilliard together. I said, do you think you can make an email introduction between me and Chen Wei Chan? And I explained to him why. He said, sure, not a problem. And so I did that, and I emailed Chen Wei Chan, and I said, do you think we can have a phone call? And we did, and I explained to him the story, and he said, okay, so can you send me the script? I'd like to read the script. So I sent him the script, and 24 hours later, he called me, and he said, Donna, this is my story too. I want to do this. I think I fainted on the spot. So when I came to, I said, oh my goodness, this is incredible. And he said, well, the only thing is I really would like if you would invite the ballerina Xiao Xiao Qiao, who I grew up with in China. And she's here in this country. We've never danced together here yet. And I think she'd be great to dance the role of your mom. So I invited Xiao Xiao. And at that point in time, I realized having Chen Wei Chan aboard, on board with me, to film my father's story was such a gift. I have to make it a longer story. So I called him up and I said, Chen, would you mind improvising a solo dance for a certain part of a new scene that I'm creating about my father's story? And he said, absolutely. So that's when a 4-minute film became a 12-minute film.
That was Donna Wang Friedman, a Steinway Hall of Fame pianist, producer, filmmaker, and creative visionary. She was selected as one of Musical America's top 30 professionals of 2024 for her outstanding contribution to the performing arts. We thank Fahima Sek of Pacifica Station WPFW in the nation's capital for sharing that conversation. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective, with contributions from Akua Holt, Fahima Sek, Thomas O'Rourke, and Steve Zeltzer. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X, formerly Twitter, @PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Polina Vasilyev. Thanks for listening.